he has danced with Grace Kelly. He's played Augusta National with Truman or Eisenhower.
Eisenhower.
He knew Bob Hope, Bing Crosby. You name it, he's done it. Of course, it's the legendary John Durr. Looking fantastic, I might add. How are you, sir?
Well, I feel pretty good. Feel pretty good. Yes, I'm not back playing golf quite like I was, but I will be.
You'd fit right in with this crowd.
I have a new putter. It hasn't had a three-putt green in it yet.
That's fantastic.
I haven't played with it yet.
We are live from the Manor Inn. There are most of the folks that participated in the event today are here just to meet you and to say hello.
Well, I hope their game was pretty good because they got to meet an old man. That's what they got to.
I wanted to.
I carry that cane, as you saw, John, but that's not to help me get along. That's to catch the girls that get away.
Maybe you can help me out with
one. Oh, yes.
Now, tell me, I asked you a few minutes ago what the thin whistle was. We passed it on number on the golf course today. There's actually a structure on course one that commemorates the Thin Whistle Society.
That was the start of Thin Whistles on number one.
Okay.
In the early days here, we had a liquor law in North Carolina at some time. And that is, you had to sell illegal liquor to get your drink. But we had a group of golfers here from Philadelphia, New York, and in the East Coast. And this was before they would go to Florida. You know, that later came as a place to go to. But they would come here and spend several weeks or sometimes all winter. And they wanted to imbibe a little while they were here. And we wound up to have a man built a house out on number 11. And there was a fellow sat in there that had some white lightning that he had for sale. And when you played the 10th hole, you could see the 11th was just down a little bit. The 10th was a par 3. And the 11th was over there. And if you wanted to get a drink, well, you whistle. So if you had a tin whistle, he would get you up a drink by the time you got there.
Really?
And the tin whistle, that's one of the legends of the tin whistle. There were some, Amos Alonzo Stagg was a member of the tin whistle. There were a member, he spent a lot of time here in Pinehurst in those days. But these people would come here, and they had their own association. When I moved to Pinehurst in 1975, I had known the history of the Tin Whistles for years, having been born in Gaston County. And I knew that, you know, it was pretty important to be in the Tin Whistle, because it's just not a run-of-the-night thing. And I made no effort to go. I was playing with General Heaton one day. General Heaton was Eisenhower's doctor. And I was just playing a friendly round with General Heaton and some other people. And he said, do you want to join the Ten Whistles? And I said, well, General, I don't think there's anybody here that knows my game or knows me for 2 years, which is one of the requirements, I believe, to get into the Ten Whistles. He said, yes, that's one of the requirements. But he said, you did not ask to come into the Ten Whistles. I said, no, I knew I wasn't eligible. Oh, he said, it was lucky that you didn't ask, because we have a rule that if you ask to come in, you're automatically dropped back 2 years.
Really?
So it's by invitation.
Well, fantastic. And you obviously are part of the group.
Oldest cat in the house.
96 years young.
Oh, that's right. Yep. They have a tournament for super seniors. And I've quit playing in the thing because they don't go beyond 90, and I don't know why they stop at that midterm. But I played it on 2 or 3 years, and I get an invitation every year, and they always tell me that it's very important for you to play. And I said, well, change your rules to fit me. I want 95 and up.
You know, I think that we'll create a division in the ONTAP Invitational.
Well,
for 95 and up.
95 and up. I mean, you go in a store and everybody is $2.99 and $3.99. I mean, we could have 95 as a starting point.
We could.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, this Whistles is a great organization, John. People from all walks of life and so forth, a lot of them have been officers in clubs around the country. I very much enjoyed the fact that they invited me without knowing me. General Heaton said, "We see you on television every Sunday, so we watch. We know a lot about your mistakes, and we've seen that." And they've been very kind to me. I had been here the second year, and they invited me to be the speaker at the spring meeting. And since there were going to be ladies there, I cleaned up my speech and went up to give a good talk and had a good time, actually, and met a lot of people. And I think it was 3 years later, maybe two, but maybe 3 years later, the chairman of the entertainment committee came to me in January, and he said, "We don't have a speaker this year. Whoever was supposed to come in from the USGA couldn't make it. And we would like very much to have you be the speaker at the Spring Tin Whistles Banquet again." And I said, "Okay, I never miss an opportunity to make a talk. And, you know, I'm there. I mean, if McGinnis says come, I'm here."
Well, I appreciate that.
But anyway, I thought it was a little strange that I would go back and speak to the same group. In 3 years, I go back. You don't do the World Series that often, you know. So I went up there and got into the thing, and this very nice gentleman, another man, introduced me. It wasn't the same man that had introduced me 2 years before. And I said, "Well, Mr. Wilson, I'm very flattered to be here with you tonight and have an opportunity to speak. I've never spoken to the same group again so quickly. Would you mind telling me why did you invite me back like this?" He hesitated for just a moment, and he said, "Well, John, we wanted to see if you'd improved any."
Fair enough. Why'd you pick Pinehurst? You could have lived anywhere. You lived in New York. You lived all over the country. Why'd you pick Pinehurst?
Well, I was born in North Carolina.
Right.
That's a starting point. I thought I had some pull in the start. I never did get much pull, and it wouldn't let me into the college when I wanted to go. But anyway, that worked out. But I love North Carolina. I first came to Pinehurst in 1935. I worked at a newspaper up in Gastonia. And I came to Pinehurst in 1935. The newspaper was a rather weak newspaper financially, but they did get enough money for me to have gas to get to Pinehurst for the school. I was to come to a training school for photographers, press photographers. And it was to be 2 days at the Carolina Hotel, and they were picking up the tab, and I thought that was pretty good. So I came down, and we had our morning session. We had some reporters, some photographers from New York were teaching, and we had a nice crowd of about 20, 25 people from all over North and South Carolina and Virginia. The photographers were here, and they said, "Well, at a quarter after 12, they said, today we're going to have lunch today now. We're going to break, and we'll be back here at 1 o'clock. And said, you can go eat down to the grill, or you can go over to the country club, get something to eat, and see a little bit of Pinehurst if you want to, and we resume at 1 o'clock here in the hotel." So I went over to the country club, and I talked with Mr. Wilson that was in there, and I said, "This is a beautiful place." He said, "You like it?" And I said, "Well, I just got here. I've never seen it before, but I like what I see." And he said, "Well, it is pretty." I said, "I was down in Augusta a few months ago, and I saw a beautiful course in Augusta." I said, it was lovely. 1935, I'd been down to Augusta, taking in the Masters. There's a gentleman standing behind me, had a three-piece suit on, and rather obese-type individual. He was not trim not like you, but he was... But he was standing back there, and he said, "Have you seen my course?" And I had not been talking to him, but he had overheard my saying, "I saw the most beautiful course in Augusta," and I think that tactic got him a little excited that I thought it was beautiful. I said, "No, sir, I have not seen your course. I just got here." He says, "Well, I have grass on the first three holes. Come, let me show you. My name is Ross." And it was the Donald Ross.
Come on.
Yes, who had heard me praise at a club somewhere else, and he is standing there. The architect himself is standing there. He said, "Come, let me show you." Well, John, there were no carts in those days, no cell phones, no recording we could do. So Mr. Ross and I walk over to the first hole of number 2 and start going down. I did not know. I'm merely a child at this time. I did not know a lot about golf and the intricacies of the game, the architectural devices, and so forth. But we walked along, and Mr. Ross started explaining to me why this grass bunker had no sand in it, why the sand bunker had grass in it. And he explained things that I never asked for and wouldn't know. And I do remember asking him one time, did you understand, can you explain to me why the flag sticks are different heights? Some of them are 3 feet, 3.5, and 4. And he says, well, in Scotland, we use whatever stick we can find. But Mr. Ross took me to the first hole, and there he had grass. It's 1935, he put grass on the first 3 holes. Well, I was excited about seeing grass on the first hole. I was really excited, and I thought about, well, I was supposed to be back at the hotel pretty soon. He said, come, let me show you the grass on the first hole. And now the second hole I also have. There's a bunker I want to explore. Oh, God, here we go on down to the second hole. And in those days, the third hole came straight back, which is now number 6 at okay. The second hole. So we turned to go to the third hole, and I said, I believe I'm stuck until he's got grass on 3 holes. I'm going to have to look at all 3 of them. Well, we finished up the third hole, and Mr. Ross did not beat a lick on it. He didn't miss a step. He said, now on number 4, I have, and off we went to 4, 5, 6, 7. We walked the full 18 holes, and me without a club in my hand.
Was he a legend then, as he is now?
He became a legend after I finished with him.
We're live from the Manor Inn, and we are joined still by the legendary John Durr. It's so good to see you. You were talking about Donald Ross before I so rudely cut you off and went to pay some bills.
Well, you did cut me off, but I'm back.
Okay.
Mr. Ross took me down, and we walked all the way into the 18th hole. And I thanked him profusely for having shown me his course, his masterpiece. And I departed as quickly as I could from the Pinehurst Country Club and beat myself up the street, beat my feet up the street to get up to the top of the Carolina Hotel where my school was going on. And I walk into my school, and they... professor, who was a photographer from New York who was running the show, said, Durr, where have you been? You're 2 hours late getting back after the lunch. Did you eat that long? And I said, no, sir, but I had an experience. I ran into Mr. Ross, and he wanted to take me around and show me the course. So I went with Mr. Ross and walked the full 18 holes at number 2. Well, he said, you missed the contest. And I said, I didn't know there was a contest. He said, I brought 2 models down from Raleigh, and everybody in the class had an opportunity to pose these models any way they wanted to, but preferably nude. And I said, what? And I missed the contest? And he said, you certainly did. And you know, I hated Donald Ross from that time on.
Oh, that is beautiful.
No, 25.
That is beautiful. 25. That is beautiful. We're selling books. We're having a good time. The entire clan from the ONTAP Invitational is here. That is a priceless story. Did you ever see him again?
That's how I met Mr. Ross. Beg pardon?
Did you ever see him again?
Oh, yes. I saw him several times, and I talked with him. But, John, I really did not know enough about golf architecture to know what to ask him.
Right.
He explained stuff on his own. Knowing that I was a nincompoop. But, it would have been great to have gone to him 5 years later and had that same visit after I'd learned a little about golf.
What brought you to golf?
My knee brought me to golf. A lot of people get to golf because they have good hands or good eyes or good legs or good teachers. When I was born, I had trouble with my left knee. I had, it worked all right most of the time. But the muscles did not develop in my left knee. The retraction muscle did not develop. And on any given day and on any circumstance, I could be walking right across the road here, and that knee would give way and would double back underneath me. so I would have only 1.5 knees. Now, you've heard of people that had 1.5 brains. Well, I had 1.5 knees. And if you can't run to first base, you don't ever get picked on the baseball team.
Right.
So my father said, I'm sorry that you can't take part in the athletics that your brother did and your sisters and all your friends. But I don't want to see you not be a part of athletics. And I'm going to build you a golf course down through the apple orchard. So we're starting at the tennis court. We had a tennis court out in the country. I live way out in the country. We had a tennis court, and I went from the tennis court. He built me a path down through the apple orchard to the creek. The water hole was there. I never did cross the creek, by the way. I stayed on the same side of the creek. But then I had to turn around and go back up the hill back to the tennis court. Well, little Johnny didn't have anybody to play with. So I had somebody had given my dad 3 clubs, 2 of which were irons, and 1 was a cut-down wedge of some type. And a driver that had been looked like it had been shattered. It could have been a hammer. I don't know to start with. But at any rate, I would play with those 4 clubs and a couple of balls down to the creek, back up, down to the creek. And, John, you know what? I never lost a match.
I guarantee it. And it was just that simple?
That was that simple. That's how I got into golf, because I could not play any other sport. Now, I did eventually went through therapeutic exercises and got my knees straightened out, and I played 1.5 years of pro basketball, which is pretty hard when you can't walk. That's how much I recovered from that.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to say this delicately, but you're not.
Do the best you can.
You're not exactly 6'6", Mr. Dare.
No, but I'm fast as hell.
Oh, God.
I can run, man. I mean, you put that firecracker under my knee, and I go. No, I had a time. I was a standing guard. You can do that with one leg.
Right.
You know who my other guard was on my team?
Who?
Guy, a little kid named Bill Friday. Did you ever hear of him? He went to North Carolina. I think he finally got his job at Chapel Hill. I don't know how good the job was, but he stayed around a long time. But Bill and I started in school together. And we were friends all the way through our growing up. And Bill was 2 years behind me. So I was a senior, he was a sophomore. And we continued on that thing. We still played together on it. But a few years ago, while he was doing that Sunday show that he did, I got him in a corner when we were doing a live show one day, and Bill was interviewing me. I was his guest, and I said, Bill, I quite never can understand where you found the fountain of youth. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, when we were in high school, I was 4 years older than you. And I said, now all of a sudden you're 6 years younger than me. What did you do? And he blustered and stuttered around. You might have thought they'd caught the quarterback in the corner somewhere. But Bill was a great, great guy. We had a wonderful man in North Carolina named Bill Friday.
I would be remiss not to ask you a question or two about Augusta National before I let you go meet your public here.
Well, go ahead.
Tell us about, by request, the Sarazen shot, the double eagle.
Mr. Sarazen shot in 1935. It was an overcast day, not too far from what we've got out here today. It had rained Friday and Saturday, and Sunday afternoon, Sarazen was playing with Walter Hagen, and they were coming along, and Sarazen got to the 15th hole, and he was still 2 strokes behind, and there's not much way to make up after the 15th hole. So all the mud in the fairway, there was no grass on, not much grass, but in 1935, that was the second year of the Masters, so there wasn't much grass. And Sarazen's ball came down behind those pine trees, and there he had a shot toward the green, but it was to the left of the pine trees. But it was in a mud place. There was muddy there. And Sarazen looked at it to see how deep the ball had gone into the mud. He recognized that he had to get on the green if he was going to make up these 2 shots. He had to get on the green. So he looked at it, and he went back, and he and the caddy talked, and the caddy says, you can't get out of there with the 3-wood. You're going to have to use the spoon. You're going to have to use the 4-wood because you've got to dig it out. It's still in the mud, and you don't want to take it out half and top it and go in the pond in front. So they fought back and forth for a few minutes what to do, and Hagen came over and said, for God's sakes, Gene, wake up your mind and hit something. He said, I got a girl waiting at the 18th green, and she'll be gone if you don't shut up. So Sarazen listened to Hagen and went ahead and hit the ball, and he hits it to the right side. Now, picture, and I'm sure you all know the 15th hole and the lake and the what have you. He hits the ball to the right side. It would not have carried the water had it gone straight toward the green. He drifted a little bit to the right, and it came down and bounced very highly. I later learned from Mr. Jones, who was one of the people that had seen it, that there was a flat rock that was still in there, because there were a lot of rocks on the course in 1935. It hit the rock, bounced up, and went onto the green, started rolling, and boom, into the hole. Sarazen and I talked about it a lot of times, and Sarazen said, I've met 30,000 people that claim they saw that hole. He said, I know every man at the green, and I know their name. There was only 13 people at the green when I hit it. So I always say to people, I was at Augusta in 1935 when Sarazen got his famous double eagle, but I did not see it. Most people claim they saw it. However, I was up on the press at the clubhouse. In those days, the press room was the second floor of the clubhouse. And I was up there talking to Damon Runyon and all of the great writers who were there. And there were some good writers there. And some caddy came up from out on the course and talked to the people below us down on the fence to wall. Said, Mr. Gene had a 2 on 15. Well, the boys had started writing their story, and they thought, well, that can't be. So it discussed it around through the press room, and it said, no, that boy's in the soup too early this morning. So they had a 2 on the 16th. About 10 minutes later, we got word, came up from a green coat that said he had double eagle at the 15th. So I rushed down to the 18th green to see him finish at 18, so I saw the last putt of his round, but I didn't see the goal in the hole.
How many Masters champions did you see finish on 18 over the years?
Well, I covered.
You were down at 15 and 16.
I was at 15 on television, but right. In the early days, I traveled all over the course. I mean, they didn't restrict me anywhere. I went, I'd go down any fairway and what have you. But I saw 62 Masters from start to finish. I don't remember seeing you. What year did you play?
I didn't. I know you love talking golf. I know that there's only probably a couple of subjects you enjoy more. So I'm going to end this by asking you, was Grace Kelly the most beautiful woman you ever
Grace
saw?
Grace Kelly, we do not even take a vote. Grace Kelly was the most beautiful woman. She grew in to be the most beautiful woman. She wasn't pretty when I first met her. She had ugly little knees, and she was knock-kneed a little bit. Grace was about 14, 15 years old when I met her. I met her in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. What do you think of that, John?
That's fantastic.
Well, I was on the way to do the Olympics in London, and her brother was a sculler. He was a crewman, and he was on the American team, and he was going with the American team. We were all going to the Olympics. And I had arranged with CBS to do an interview with every American winner on the way over on the boat. This was an opportunity to spend time with them. So I had a place on the boat to do my interviews, as you can understand. And I had Kelly settle up, and he said to us, I'm going to bring my father to the interview if I may, because his father was pretty well known. And I said, sure. And he said, how about my kid sister? She listens to you on the radio in Philadelphia. But she can't understand why you're in New York and she hears you in Philadelphia. I said, she's got good ears. That's all. But I said, bring your sister. So here comes this little girl, knock-kneed little girl, short dress on, pretty hair, not very outstanding, but it was Grace Kelly at 14. But we became friends that day, and I was nice to her, and then so later she got up, and I was actually invited to MC when she won the Oscar for High Noon.
Really?
And she came to New York a lot of times, and one day we were having lunch at Shores, and she had come up with some people from Philadelphia, and they were going shopping, and she didn't want to go shopping. She and I sat at Shores and let them all leave, and she looked at her watch, and she said, "Oh, my goodness, John, I've missed the 2 o'clock train. I'm going to have to wait till 3 o'clock to take the train to Philadelphia. What can we do?" Well, I thought of a lot of things, but I said... I said, I suggest is that we just order coffee, more coffee, and go to the bathroom, more coffee, and go to the bathroom, and eventually we'll have 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and you can go to Philadelphia. Well, everybody left Toot Shores that day. I had table number 2, and everybody left, and it was just Grace and me there. But somebody saw us, and the next day, my wife was playing golf at Fort Lauderdale. She was away for the winter season. Widow season, and she's in Fort Lauderdale, and so somebody saw Dorothy Kilgallen. You remember Dorothy Kilgallen? What's My Line? It used to be on television. And the next day in the New York Journal American, Dorothy Kilgallen had an item that caught the attention of the newsroom around CBS, and they rushed around to tell me, "Well, you made the gossip column today." And Dorothy Kilgallen had written in her paper, without me knowing it, that could it have been sports that John Durr and Grace Kelly were discussing yesterday at Shores while holding hands under the table? So the boys in the newsroom went crazy with this. I said, they got it all wrong. We weren't holding hands. I was feeling her knee.
What did Mrs. Durr think of this?
She's in Fort Lauderdale.
It's so good to spend time with you. It's so good to see you. Thank you for stopping by. You're welcome to stay.
No, I won't stay.
But you can side bucks. The show can only go downhill once you take that headset off.
Half a bottle of water will never keep me to stay. But I want you to know I enjoy being with you. You're a great guy. Now, if I want you to tell people that we brought some books up here.
And you can...
But if... They're all gone. Well, I've got more coming next week, so don't worry. I may add another chapter next week, too. But it'll go higher next week. But let me tell you, John, I'd like the people to order the book from this webpage. And I have a website on there, and my daughter Cricket handles everything. But if you go on your internet and put www, and then one word, johndursports.com, you can order my book, and Cricket will get it out to you in 2 or 3 days.
D-E-R-R is how you spell
John
the last
Durr last name.
It's there?
I thank you, sir.